This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is an OTM Podcast Extra. I'm Bob Garfield. Here at WNYC, Brian Lehrer hosts a live public affairs show. And recently, he had a segment that was so up our alley, we decided to send it down our podcast feed. His guests were Columbia University President Lee Ballinger and University of Chicago law professor Jeffrey Stone, editors of The Free Speech Century, a collection of essays by scholars marking 100 years since the Supreme Court issued the three decisions that established the modern notion of free speech. The fact is, whether it's fake news or money in politics, we're still arguing over the First Amendment. And their book lays out the origins of the argument just after the First World War. Here's Brian.
How did modern free speech history start in 1919? President Bollinger.
You have a period of time in which the world was really coming apart in many ways. Obviously, World War I was happening. But there was also the Russian Revolution. There was unrest in labor sectors. This was a time of enormous controversy and a sense of the modern world was coming apart. And one of the things that happens in periods like this is that intolerance goes up. And a lot of people were brought before courts for speeches that they gave, including a candidate for president of the United States, Eugene Debs, leader of the Socialist Party. And those cases work their way, some of them, a few of them, three of them, up to the Supreme Court. And in a series of decisions, the court unanimously held the speech was not protected by the First Amendment. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. wrote those opinions. But that was the beginning of what now is 100 years of extraordinary jurisprudence.
Just for the record and listeners' curiosity, and especially since democratic socialism is back in American politics as a mainstream thing, what was it that Eugene Debs said as a presidential candidate that was deemed not protected by the First Amendment?
Well, in theory, it was not about democratic socialism as such. He was giving a speech in Ohio about democratic socialism. And during the course of the speech, he was near a jail facility in which there were several individuals who were imprisoned because of their opposition to the draft. And Debs pointed in that direction and basically applauded them for their courage. And for that—
The draft into World War I.
Right. And for doing that, he was prosecuted under the Espionage Act of 1917 for engaging in speech that could lead people or encourage people to obstruct the draft. And he maintained that it violated the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court unanimously upheld his conviction.
Not even lead to violence, just lead to more draft dodging?
Right, but lead to only in a very indirect sense. Yeah. It's not as if he was advocating it. He was basically simply recognizing the courage of people who had done this, and that was sufficient to say that he was essentially causing people to obstruct the draft.
Wow. And yet, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes is a hero in your narrative, and largely for changing his mind. So can you tell us some more of the Justice Holmes story?
Well, in those cases, Holmes said, there's a classic question here. When people speak and advocate dangerous ideas or highly offensive ideas, what should be the limits of free speech and when should the government be able to step in? And he announced in the course of these decisions the clear and present danger test. That's how we would analyze. Now, those are vague terms, and they interpreted them in an anti-free speech way in modern sensibilities at that time. But within a matter of months, another case came before the court, and Holmes reversed his position and started to say things like, really the marketplace of ideas is important and seeking truth, and we want to have a First Amendment that respects the rights of citizens to discuss issues and to try to arrive at the truth. And so he gave a new meaning, a very pro-free speech meaning, to clear and present danger.
Part of what's interesting about that is the fact that Holmes changed his mind was itself an example of free speech. Because when he wrote those opinions in the fall of 1919, upholding the convictions of Debs and the other defendants, that summer he had conversations with a number of other individuals who criticized him for taking the position that he did and upholding the convictions, and he changed his mind. And when he came back the following fall, he basically wrote these elegant dissenting opinions, which basically gave real substance to the principle of free speech, even though now he was writing only for himself and Louis Brandeis. But the key thing about it is that in itself was a great example of how free speech matters.
You describe the U.S. as unique in the extent of its free speech protections. People may not realize this, casually thinking that there are a lot of democracies in Europe and elsewhere that also have freedom of speech, like we have freedom of speech. How would you describe where the U.S. stands alone?
The most dramatic and most obvious example is on the issue of hate speech, where many Western democracies have prohibited hate speech, defined somewhat ambiguously, whereas in the United States, the Supreme Court, with every justice, both liberal and conservative, for the last half century, embracing the position that there is no such thing as hate speech that can be restricted consistent with the First Amendment. And the court over time has come to the view that the government simply may not restrict the expression of particular points of view or particular ideas because those ideas are thought to be offensive or hurtful or dangerous unless they create a clear and present danger of grave harm, a test that has been applied with extraordinary rigor in the United States. And the reason I think we are different from other countries at this point is that we have learned the lessons of our own failures, that our court has come to the view that when we have allowed restrictions of speech and then we've looked back later, we recognize that we were wrong. We had done it badly.
What's an example of that?
Well, an example is the World War I cases that we discussed earlier. Another example would be during the McCarthy era, where the Supreme Court initially upheld the criminal convictions of individuals who were leaders of the Communist Party. With hindsight, the court recognized that they had given into the temptation of allowing ideas that were seen as offensive or hurtful or dangerous to be prohibited. And with hindsight, they realized that was a mistake.
And how much would you say, President Bollinger, that freedom of speech, 20th century U.S. style, has been contagious around the world?
We have 100 years of jurisprudence of free speech. It took us 50 years to get it to where it is today. Almost everybody in America thinks of freedom of speech as part of the identity of being an American. We're proud of it. It's really the last 50 years in which that happened. And in that 50 years, it's been the Supreme Court and judicial decisions that have refined this doctrine enormously. And it's very distinctive in democracies around the world, largely because of that jurisprudence. You can look every place around the world and you will find echoes of the major decisions of the United States Supreme Court, most notably New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964.
Now we're in a time of contracting free speech with the rise of authoritarian governments around the world. We see what's happening in many countries. Russia and China are both distressing, and how we thought they were liberalizing for a while, and now those governments are retrenching and digging in hard. Saudi Arabia murdered Jamal Khashoggi, by all accounts. Do you see a boomerang effect from any of those situations affecting the United States?
I don't think so. I hope not, certainly. I think there are issues being raised now by our president, for example, condemning the media and questioning in some ways the vitality and the legitimacy of a free and open government, calling on the need to, as he said, open up the libel laws, for example. But I don't see much reaction to that in a positive direction from that standpoint. If anything, there's a concern now, I think, that maybe there is too much free speech. Social media is complicating things because individuals now are increasingly inclined to get all of their information from particular sites which have a strong ideological bias, and that's in some sense part of free speech, but it also is inconsistent with the basic assumptions about how a democracy operates. So I think there are challenges that we face, but I think they're not so much because of the authoritarianism we're seeing elsewhere, although there is that theme in some of our president's statements.
Do you think that Trump, whether you love or hate what he stands for, has affected or diminished free speech in the U.S.? I think he and his defenders would say he's just exercising his rights of free speech by calling the press the enemy of the people, for example, that he doesn't give up that right when he becomes president.
It's not unconstitutional necessarily. That's a complicated question. But to have the leader of the country regularly trying to undermine, and through false statements, the role of the press in America is very, very dangerous.
Let's take a phone call. And Carrick in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Carrick.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the whole idea of Alex Jones, who, for those of you who don't know, has been banned off the internet, all social media platforms, for simply doing things like questioning government narratives. I just wanted to see if you think that big tech and other government agencies have crossed the line and infringing on his First Amendment rights. Or do you think that's acceptable, what has been done to him? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Stone.
Well, to the extent that Alex Jones has been banned, I don't know whether that's the case, but to the extent that he's been banned from using various social media, I assume it's by the social media entities themselves. And in theory, they have the authority, they have the right to decide who can and cannot have access to their platforms. In the same way that the New York Times or WNYC can decide who they'll invite on. Now, it's a little more complicated in the realm of social media because when social media came into existence, the government assumed that anyone would have access and that these platforms would not be engaging in any kind of censorship or any kind of selective admission to the platforms. And that's changed in recent years, and that's complicated things. But there's no First Amendment issue there because no one who's excluding him is the government itself.
We also, Jeff and I, make the point in the book by the essayist we've invited and by our own comments that one of the greatest questions of the time is how are we going to treat, for First Amendment purposes, the major new communication technology of the internet and social media platforms. And over the past 100 years, there has been a division. The print media has been protected against any form of regulation, basically, and radio and TV have had multiple types of regulation, the Fairness Doctrine, equal time provision. And the question now is, will this new technology of communication, the internet, have one of those or something different? And that's a very complicated question.
And where does it stand constitutionally?
Well, I think we don't know the answer to that. That's part of the puzzle here. So you can say that the social media platforms have become so dominant, and in particular Facebook and Twitter, that it is appropriate under the broadcast regulation cases for the government to set up an agency that would participate in non-censorship ways in the development of speech on those platforms. Or you can say that has been a mistake in the past, the Red Lion decision on broadcasting, and the print media model should be the one that applies the social media platform.
What was the Red Lion decision?
Red Lion decision was in the late 1960s, and it upheld government regulation of radio and TV.
And that was before cable. So was it based on scarcity? Was it based on, in effect, monopoly that the few big networks had?
It was based on scarcity, which is a complicated – I mean, this is right down our First Amendment doctrine alley. And my own view is that there was a play with both kinds of systems, protection against the government, some form of government regulation, and whether the rationale stood up or not is an open question in my mind.
One of the ways that I think it's possible to imagine regulation of social media platforms like Facebook would be to implement the Fairness Doctrine for radio and television onto Facebook by saying, for example, that if Facebook sends you to a particular site, or if you go and look at a particular site that has a strong ideological component, that it automatically has to then send you the alternative side, the opposite side. You don't have to read it. They can't force you to do that, but they have to actually expose you to it. And the idea is to try to bring people into a better place in terms of understanding that the world is more complicated than only from one side.
And Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question for your guests is this. Could they address the rise of attempts to restrict free speech from the left? That seems to be extremely unprecedented in American history. It's usually been the left that's been the target of restrictions of free speech. And now you have groups in the name of anti-hate speech who want to restrict free speech. Am I correct in saying that that's unprecedented in American history? And what can your guests enlighten us about that? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, I think you're right that for the most part, historically, it is the liberal side that has been the advocate of free speech and the political conservative side that's most of the time been the one who's defended restrictions on speech. This is true, for example, in World War I. It's true during the McCarthy era. It's true during the Vietnam War era and so on. And we do see a reversal of that at the moment on college campuses, as you say, with respect to the left trying to restrict the freedom of speech. And I personally find that very troubling. I think it's short-sighted. It doesn't understand why the kind of causes that the left has believed in and still believes in deeply were made possible only because of a commitment to freedom of speech. And that if individuals and if government were entitled or if universities were empowered to restrict speech that others found to be offensive or inappropriate or immoral or wrongheaded, then in this country we would never have had a civil rights movement. We would never have had a women's rights movement. We've never had a gay rights movement. Those came about only because ideas that most people found offensive could be addressed and could be espoused and could be listened to. And I think that it's important for people on the left to recognize that the success that the left has had is largely the product of free speech, and they endanger themselves if they undermine that.
Though sometimes we have in recent years, I think, examples of provocateurs on the left pushing their rights at public universities, state universities, which neither of your schools are, your private universities, under the banner of free speech to push racist and sexist speech in particular as they criticize what they see as political correctness and try to provoke a backlash to make the left look bad or even provoke a violent backlash in some cases to make the left look bad. And now that's largely a political issue, but would it be accurate to say, President Bollinger, that at Columbia University, you would have the right as a private institution to set different standards for when somebody could do that or a conservative club could invite someone to do that, which is sometimes the way it comes about, you would have more right under the Constitution in that respect to limit that than SUNY would?
That's correct. So the First Amendment really only applies to what's called state action, actions by the government. And with respect to public universities, for First Amendment purposes, they are state actors. For purposes of the First Amendment, private universities are not state actors, therefore not governed by the First Amendment. However, every major university and college in the country has voluntarily embraced a kind of First Amendment mentality. And certainly I have and we have at Columbia and Jeff has at the University of Chicago. That said, a couple of things are important here. Number one, as we pointed out, the free speech jurisprudence in the United States is the most extreme, most protective in human history, and the most elaborate and we think the most sound. One element of that is how far should it go in protecting speech that is attacking other groups because of race or ethnicity or gender. That is a reasonable debate to have, just how far. And there have been different views about this in the history of the First Amendment. We've chosen to go very far in this country in protecting speech. Both Jeff and I, for somewhat different reasons, have written in favor of that position. But it is a legitimate debate. The other thing to note is that there's an overlap between what the First Amendment says and private worlds of speech, how we conduct ourselves. And that's important that we see those two spheres.
Vanessa in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi. Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm interested to hear them comment on the anti-BDS legislation and state action in that regard. It's hard for me to understand the rationale for saying that government contracts, eligibility for government contracts, can be conditioned on taking a particular political position in opposition to what I believe is lawful conduct, i.e. boycott, divest, and sanctions.
Professor Stone, some states are actually doing this. I believe New York is one of them.
My view would be that it is not consistent with the First Amendment for the government to basically refuse to contract with individuals who take a particular political position that the members of the state government disapprove of, and that that's actually not a complicated question, and that such laws are unconstitutional.
And there's a bill that actually just passed the U.S. Senate endorsing the states that will deny contracts to companies that engage in boycotting Israel. Is this headed for court? Is this going to the Supreme Court?
I would think there's a very good chance of it. I am personally against the BDS movement for a variety of reasons, but I think it is antithetical to the First Amendment to penalize, for the government to penalize people who advocate that view.
How about Citizens United? The Supreme Court for more than 40 years now has equated money with speech. How new a notion is that in the history of the world?
Well, it is a relatively new notion. The Supreme Court initially was ambivalent about the question, but in Citizens United, the court, in a 5-4 decision, basically took a position that effectively invalidated many forms of regulation of campaign expenditures in our political process. And the interesting thing about it is in this case, it was the 5 more conservative justices who took the more aggressive free speech stance, holding laws regulating campaign finance unconstitutional, and the 4 more liberal justices who took a position that would have allowed the government to restrict speech in this context. And so what you have there is a conflict between two different visions of the First Amendment. On the side that basically held that these laws are unconstitutional, their view is that the government cannot tell people that you've spoken enough. That basically you have a right to give as many speeches as you want, to hand out as many leaflets as you want, or to give as much money as you want, and the government cannot say you've said enough, sit down and shut up. On the other side, the dissenters in the case basically said that protecting the functioning of the democracy is a central function of what the First Amendment is about. And when speech reaches a point where it basically undermines the working of democracy, it can be limited, not based on any particular point of view, but on the magnitude of the expenditures themselves.
So, I mean, you wrote in the book that the underlying reason for freedom of speech is to protect and strengthen democracy. So now we're in this position where political influence of the wealthy few by spending all that money is widely seen as corrupting and diminishing democracy, even while free speech is considered a foundation of it. We just have to be resigned to whoever happens to be on the Supreme Court at a given moment making these judgments as to which damages democracy more?
Well, it turns out that who is on the Supreme Court now, the Supreme Court rules, is really important, and you just have to keep working at this. That's the history of 100 years. Jeff has pointed out a profound question at the core of the First Amendment. Is the First Amendment about only stopping the government from censoring or being involved in limiting speech? Or is the First Amendment also involved in allowing the government to help with the quality of public debate? And that plays out not only in campaign finance, but in new technologies like Facebook and Twitter and a number of other areas as well. Profound question that we have to resolve.
How do you see, by the way, Professor Stone, the current, maybe we could call it the Roberts, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh court in terms of any particular free speech dimensions?
Well, I think one striking thing about the current makeup of the court is that it is likely to divide 5-4 in the most important and ideological type cases, whether it's free speech or religion or criminal procedure or whatever, along partisan lines. And that's unprecedented. To have 5 justices appointed by Republican presidents who tend to vote one way and 4 justices appointed by Democratic presidents to vote the other way really threatens the integrity of the court as a neutral and detached a body that is not acting out partisan interests, but is acting out constitutional and legal interests. That's very troubling. In terms of the court itself, I think that this will play out on a number of issues, but on the free speech area, campaign finance is an obvious one. Regulation of speech about abortion is another obvious one. We've already seen an example of that last term.
Speech about abortion, remind me?
Yeah, so California had a law that required facilities that provide reproductive health care to individuals to make available information about the fact that the state provides abortion counseling and free abortion services and other reproductive health services for those who can't afford it. In a 5-4 decision, with the Republican-appointed justices on one side and the Democrat-appointed justices on the other, the Supreme Court held the law was unconstitutional, that the state could not compel these facilities, most of which were anti-abortion facilities, who basically were treating people, women who wanted health care, and moving them away from abortion as an option, and not telling them that there were free abortion services and reproductive health care services available from the state. They held it violated the free speech rights of the providers not to be compelled to inform individuals of this factually true information.
Interesting. And yet, aren't there some state laws that compel doctors to provide women adverse information if they're considering an abortion?
Precisely. And the principle that the court relied upon, that the conservative justices relied upon in this case, would seem very, in a matter of principle, to require the invalidation of the laws that require doctors to disclose all sorts of information, some of which is not accurate, to women considering abortions. We'll see what happens.
I've always wondered why, in the case of states that require the risks of abortions to be presented to a woman considering one, that they can't also be compelled to provide the risks and benefits of pregnancy and childbirth and child rearing in their whatever the particular circumstances are.
Right. Well, the issue of abortion is obviously one that carries a particularly deep division in our society. And this is where there's a very strong effort to try to deter people from having abortions for those who believe that abortion is murder. And the court now finds itself in a position where my own view is that there's probably 5 justices on the Supreme Court who would vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. And although they may not get to that point very quickly, that viewpoint, I think, will shape a lot of their decisions if they confront more First Amendment questions along these lines.
Since your book starts in the era of World War I and the free speech legal battles over that, I think a memory or at least family lore that we're about to hear from David in Glen Cove might be very relevant. David, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Brian. I just wanted to relate the story, and it's pretty factual, that my grandmother was arrested while a student at Barnard College. She was an officer in the socialist club at Barnard College, and she and her fiancé were at a rally in Madison Square Garden passing out leaflets entitled, "Will You Be Drafted?" And she was subsequently arrested, and her prominent family got her off because they said that she didn't really understand the full impact of what she was doing because she was a woman, of course, and women didn't really – were under the control of men, supposedly. So,
what was the charge? Do you know?
Well, the charge was – I don't know if it was sedition, but it was whatever the law was against, the conscription, fighting the conscription or related to conscription law that was just recently passed.
David, thank you for that. For that family story. And it goes back to what you were talking about at the beginning of the segment with respect to the socialist candidate for president of the United States at that time, Eugene Debs, being found guilty. Guilty of what? I forget. For just advocating or supporting the right of people to not get drafted.
So I think one of the things that we're trying to do with the book, but Jeff and I have tried to do for many, many years, is to help people realize that what we take today as America's principle of freedom of speech and press, relatively new in our history, extraordinary in terms of its social accomplishments and legal accomplishments, and something counterintuitive and fragile. That is, there's no reason to think that the United States is now invulnerable to the rise of intolerance that we've seen in past periods. As Jeff pointed out, the World War, and I started with the World War I period, is extraordinary in the repression that occurred. So is the McCarthy era. We have wondered in the book whether the United States over the past 50 years has just not faced the level of insecurity and fear and panic that World War I and post-World War II eras brought, and have wondered, will we stand up now to the kind of intolerance that was very visible and painful in those periods? Are we strong enough? Is the jurisprudence strong enough to resist it?
And there we leave it with the president of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger, and University of Chicago law professor Jeffrey Stone. They are the co-editors of a new book of essays by many First Amendment scholars about free speech, its evolution, and current challenges in the United States, a book called The Free Speech Century. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can catch The Brian Lehrer Show between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m. Eastern on WNYC or at WNYC.org. The show is also available as a podcast. And OTM listeners, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter at onthemedia.org/newsletter. It is the best newsletter ever. It's the On the Media newsletter at onthemedia.org/newsletter. You won't be sorry.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.